The book Last Train from Hiroshima, and we're heading into our last hour, but your chance to jump in with Charles Pellegrino, author of so many other cool books, great researcher, great scientist, does very interesting projects just like this one. This one's very personal, I think. At least I get the feeling of it as I'm reading through it. And it is a book which attempts to explain Hiroshima from almost from the standpoint for the first several chapters in terms of milliseconds, as the bomb is going out in concentric circles in milliseconds. And we can talk a little bit more still about the random nature of this blast, but it's time for you to ask and to comment. Charles Pellegrino, Last Train from Hiroshima, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So, Charles Pellegrino, the author of Last Train from Hiroshima, let's start with Todd in Minnesota on Coast to Coast AM. Todd?
Yes, Charles. My question is, I've heard from different reports that the bomb had actually been dropped as a test to see what its capabilities were instead of it actually being dropped to end the war. What is your view on that?
Well, part of what it was, they were multitasking with this weapon. Part of the reason that they left Hiroshima and Nagasaki virtually untouched by any bombing runs at all, also Kokura, was so that they would have before and after pictures and that they could scientifically compare exactly what the damage was that the bomb had done, that they would know none of these craters were created by previous bombings. Charles Sweeney, we hear a lot about Paul Tibbetts, but he was not really typical of the men who were on these missions. Charles Sweeney went out of his way. As I had mentioned before, a good flak hit could have set that bomb off in the plane. Charles Sweeney, during the second bombing, flew over Kokura, which was pretty much entirely a military target. It had very little of a civilian population around it, as Nagasaki had, and Sweeney did not want to hit a very large civilian population. The target was covered over by smoke from fire bombings of the town next door the night before, and Sweeney flew through flak, then did what he was against orders to do. He turned around and came back and tried to acquire the target a second time, flying again through flak that was coming in very, very close. And then he turned around and flew through a third time, still could not acquire the target, and had to leave with the first fighters beginning to come up, because Kokura was one of the few places that was still very heavily defended. Then when he reached Nagasaki, he was supposed to hit Nagasaki Central, use the rebound effect that you had in Hiroshima, and then let a shotgun effect go, let the blast go north, confined between this huge valley where it would have, in the center of the valley, where it would have taken out all of the Mitsubishi offices. Instead, he dropped the bomb 2.5 miles upriver, used the shotgun effect to take out all the Mitsubishi targets, all the factories, including one of the factories was more than a quarter mile long, and the shotgun effect only went down through part of Nagasaki, and Paul Tibbetts had wanted Sweeney, everything all the way on up through court-martial for having not used the rebound effect in central Nagasaki, having dropped the bomb 2.5 miles upriver instead. And Tibbetts said, you could have killed another 20,000 people and that you should be court-martialed for not having done so.
So, very interesting, but speaking specifically to that idea of a test, then it was a test only in that it was the first one. But if the Japanese had responded to the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima in a positive way, from our perspective, by agreeing to a surrender, that would have been part of the plan. That was not, it wasn't a test entirely on its own, but
no.
there was still the intention of getting them to surrender from the very beginning.
In fact, after Nagasaki, There was the 3 days in between where all we dropped on Japan were threatening letters, some of which were written by James Clavell and James Michener, and promising utter destruction by more atomic bombs and such. I mean, imagine in today's terms, threatening letters threatening nuclear hell written by Stephen King. That's what these letters were like that were being dropped all over Japan. And there was a revolution in the palace. There was suicide. There were people being hacked to pieces. Finally, the people who sided with the emperor everyone kind of came over to the emperor's side. But this wasn't really happening until the night of August 13th and 13th to 14th, when we sent in 3,500 planes, anything that could fly, and we resumed firebombing the whole country with history's biggest mass firebomb raid. And that is what finally sealed the surrender. The firebombings that were days after the bombing of Nagasaki.
Robert is on a first-time caller line in Houston on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino. Robert?
Hey, Charles, how you doing? So, yeah, I've always been interested. When the bombs were dropped, you know, the people that were the man and the woman that were holding each other when the bomb went off in Hiroshima, I think it was, their image was burned onto the walls. Is that like a natural thing that happens, or is there other images on the walls? And
there are many images on walls, but I think the story of a man and woman holding each other is a bit of a myth. The story of someone who was found in prayer is not a myth, but that wasn't a shadow on a wall. That was a woman in her home. She was completely carbonized before the little temple in her home. She was completely carbonized in a position of prayer at that moment. There's one instance that I've looked at where there was one wall that was preserved in Nagasaki, and there's a ladder, and it was a ladder near a watchtower, and the shadow of the ladder is on the wall. There was a man standing next to the ladder, and it gives you a sense of how it was about a third of a second to a half of a second for the image to be burned onto the wall, because his head is blurry. It's a sharp image except for the head. So this man is evidently turning to look in the direction of the bomb or of the airplanes that were suddenly getting very loud with their engines and trying to turn out of the way of the bomb.
Right.
But there's a very, very blurry image next to him near the ladder, which the more you look at it, you see that this is probably a second person who has seen something or heard something and is in the process of jumping down off of the ladder as the bomb flashes on.
Robert, you'll very much enjoy the book Last Train from Hiroshima. Charlie is in Canada on the international line for Charles Pellegrino. Charlie?
Hey, Ian. Hey, Charles.
Hello.
I have a couple questions for you, Charles. I just picked up your book the other night, actually, from Amazon. I actually ordered it through Amazon, so I'm not sure if that's just a Amazon.ca or Amazon.com issue, but... Mm-hmm.
Well,
Charlie, hang on a second.
Charles will explain. Go ahead, Charles.
Okay.
Yeah, it's tonight. It started tonight. So if you got it 3 days ago, that's fine. But Amazon is now boycotting any books by Macmillan, including this one, as of tonight. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, one of the questions was about in your book how could you speculate how the formations of fireworms and the other anomalies. Or happen from as a result of a fusion reaction, and
we don't know. The fireworms are kind of understandable. We sometimes see things like that in forest fires. In fact, after the Twin Towers collapse along Vesey Street, not quite as large, but there were fireworms and whirlwinds up to three stories high. Some of the other things that survivors described we just don't know what was happening. When Nancy Cantwell describes these, the night of the blue fireflies in Hiroshima, we don't know what that was, if that was some static electricity charge or what. She saw them everywhere, coming and going, all over the city. Some of them, she said, approached her until she just curled up into a ball, saying, and this is someone who was shot during the Korean War and survived all sorts of other things, and she said she was never as frightened in her life as the night of the fire, blue fireflies. And she interpreted them as, because they were everywhere and because people had died everywhere, she interpreted them as the spirits of the people who had been killed by the atomic bomb.
Let's go to Jim in Wichita, Kansas, on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino.
Hey, good morning there, Ian. Good morning, Charles. Hey, I just wanted to relay a personal experience I've actually had. I spent a year in Japan when I was in the Marine Corps back in 1980, and I was in Iwakuni at the air base, and I used to go to Hiroshima quite often to go up to the nightclubs and stuff up there, and I spent a lot of time up in Peace Park, and I've actually stood at Ground Zero where the bomb detonated over that shrine building, and I've gone to the museum, and I tell you, one of the most, it's something I'll never forget, the things I saw in that museum that the Japanese had put in there. But the one thing that sticks out most of anything is they have this cross-section of this brick wall that I'm not sure where it came from. It was somewhere around the area where the bomb went off. And they have a cross-section of a cutout. And the Japanese put rebar through the center of these brick walls to reinforce them.
Yeah.
And the blast was so powerful that when it went off, the brick wall stayed intact, but the rebar inside was all deformed and twisted, and it was the freakiest thing I've ever seen. And after I saw that, I was just like, this is just unbelievable, the power that these nuclear weapons have. And at the end of the museum, they have a book that everyone can sign and leave comments. And I wrote in there, may this never happen again on the face of this earth.
And that is the whole point, that we have to remember what happened. And this isn't really a book about the past. It's about the future.
Charles, I want to ask you about, as long as Jim brought up some of these anomalies, we never talked about the neutrinos, right?
Right.
What you've been able to uncover in your research on how much damage was being done by neutrinos from the blast passing through human bodies.
Well, the neutrinos from the blast really didn't do anything. They passed through people. They passed right through the earth without noticing it. So the one man, another double survivor, whose wife unfortunately was almost directly below the bomb, the neutrinos passed through her and all the way through the earth, coming out somewhere near Easter Island, the ones that had passed through her body, going right through the earth and coming out somewhere near Easter Island before the blast wave hit her. So it's... the particles I think you're talking about are the heavy ions, and that's a fairly new discovery, and it sort of explains some of the strange ways that some people who seem to be in safe places, who were found and who were dead within less than an hour from and started bleeding from every part of their body from the pores in their skin, that some of us wondered, is this true? Is this mother describing a time frame that is in some way off? But when you look at the goggles of someone like Joe Fuoco and the goggle plate that he was wearing, even at the distance of the plane, you had these particles that were passing through his goggles over the bridge of his nose.
Right.
And these are very heavy ions, either iron or tungsten or something else from the core of the bomb that would have been following the magnetic field lines at a fraction of the speed of light, at least 30% the speed of light. And what that comes down to is it's almost like The one that passed through his goggles would have been roughly equivalent to firing, having a pitcher fire a baseball through his goggles or through his body, but all the mass of that base, but passing through his body, the force of that baseball, but passing through an area that is narrower than a human hair. So those that passed through the bodies of the people who were on the planes or on the ground, each one of them would have basically cauterized a path through someone's body about the diameter of a human hair, cauterizing blood and having little blood clots move entirely through someone's body. If there's metal, it might intercept it a bit easier, which is probably why Paul Tibbetts said he felt the fillings in his teeth vibrate at one point and then emit a taste in his mouth like melted lead. And
he was
that's
in the
what
plane.
Happened to the people in the planes who were about at least 6 miles away at that time. And if you were within the magnetic field lines where a lot of these particles would have been guided, as appears to have happened to one child, it would have been like relativistic machine gun fire going right through his body. So it's no wonder that he seemed completely unharmed and then started bleeding through the pores in his skin and was dead within what seemed to his mother to be a matter of minutes.
John is in St. Louis on a wildcard line for Charles Pellegrino from Last Train from Hiroshima. John?
It's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Pellegrino. I think it's just really important for us to look at these things. I have pictures on my Google screensavers that rotate some of the pictures of Hiroshima, and the photographer who was there after the blast and who survived. I think it was George Santayana said, "Before those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it." And what I also believe, as we observe the tsunami and 9/11, Katrina, that what happens to another actually happens to us on a conscious level.
Yes.
And I know that you understand that. And, you know, I bless you for your what you went through in 9/11. My brother lives and works on Wall Street, and he was there. And I just think what you're doing is forcing us to look at this reality is a gift. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We'll get to more coming up. It's been a busy half hour here. Jesse, are we going to jump here? Are we on time? We got a minute or two. Can we get one more in? Okay, let's try to get one more in on Coast to Coast before the bottom of the hour. And Daniel is in Fresno on Coast to Coast. Daniel?
Hi there, guys. I have one question and a comment for everybody out there. Have you read the book The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell? And if not, I would suggest it. It has to do with this topic.
Okay.
Fate of the Earth? About 1980, I think that came out. 81.
More questions and comments coming up for Charles Pellegrino, the author of Last Train from Hiroshima. But that gives me a little time here, Charles, to ask about some of the other things that you think you have uncovered for the first time or put together with a perspective that really helps us understand Hiroshima best for the first time. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So back to the phones for Charles Pellegrino, author of The Last Train from Hiroshima. We heard the story about how about 300 survivors of Hiroshima fought to get on the last train out, only to find themselves pulling into Nagasaki just as the next bomb was dropping. And of those 300 that had survived, only about 30 then survived the attack on Nagasaki as well. Eventually, the Japanese would surrender and no more bombs were dropped. And hopefully it will always be that the horrific images of Nagasaki serve as an inspiration to keep that from ever happening again. And efforts are being made even as we speak. I just saw today's headlines again talking about that. So let's hope that we never have to go through what they went through at Hiroshima. If you don't understand it, take a look at the book or take a listen next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Ray is on a wild card line on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino. Ray?
Yeah, I have two quick questions to ask. One is, if we were to drop a nuclear weapon of the kind we have today on Hiroshima, how big an area would we destroy? And the other one is, how powerful have these nuclear weapons gotten today, and are they keeping it a secret how much power that ones they have on the drawing board or actually out there in production are?
Well, the most powerful ones were detonated in the 50s and 60s, and they found that the more you increased it from kilotons to megatons all the way on up to 50 megatons, that there was just a matter of diminishing returns on the amount of destruction that was done by the bomb, that most of the destruction was done fairly in close. So most of the weapons we're talking about today, most of them are no more than about one megaton, which is still one of those things that's pretty bad. And tactical nuclear weapons, they're down to pinpoint targeting down to as low as one kiloton, or one-tenth the force of what the Hiroshima bomb was. What's been discovered by the military as time went on, that it's a lot better to, you get more of an effect by pinpointing conventional explosives right on targets than you would by setting off a nuclear weapon over a wide area. So really, as the world is moving on with today's technology, nuclear weapons are something that would be considered not so much a tactical weapon as a terror weapon, really.
Mike is
destroying whole cities.
Mike is in Michigan on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino. Mike?
Hey, good morning, Ian. Very, very tragic topic, but you're doing a good job to keep it respective. My comment really was some of the great historians, rogue historians like Howard Zinn, who just passed away, and even Michael Pereni for Rose, that we had the Japanese on the run. You know, we had them beat at Coral Sea. We beat them at Iwo Jima, and surrender was just right around the corner. And the only reason we dropped the bomb was to beat the Soviets to the punch. And that dropping the bomb, both of them, was actually the beginning of the Cold War. And I just want to know what you thought about that.
They didn't. There were the fire bombings, and it seems that in the end, it was the fire bombings with the two atomic bombs within these fire bombings that really brought about the surrender. There was a revolution within the Imperial Palace. You just have to look back to that time as a period in which the world just went mad. And as far as what the intelligence was and the statistics that President Truman was working on, there is evidence still today of what Truman thought was going to happen when he went into Japan. He ordered the United States Mint to print up, in preparation for the invasion of the mainland, 400,000 Purple Hearts, which ended up not having to be used, but we ended up using those Purple Hearts on through the Korean War into Vietnam and through Vietnam, through about 50,000 soldiers that we lost in Vietnam, into Gulf War I, Gulf War II, and the Afghanistan War, and we are still using those World War I, 1945 Purple Hearts.
World War II.
I'm sorry. World War II. Split.
But isn't
that... still using those 1945 World War II Purple Hearts. Haven't run out of them yet. And that is really what our commanders and what Truman and MacArthur thought we were going into.
You know, I have an uncle who is very much a pacifist. He does not, he's not the kind who advocates for war, and he's got a big heart. But he always tells me that he was on one of these ships that was heading toward Japan. He had already served in Europe. And they'd already gotten their orders that they were going to be on their way to invade, you know, this island hopping war, you know, in order to take over, eventually get to the mainland. And he said that, you know, he never regrets the bomb dropping. He knows he would have been dead on a beach somewhere. And I find that an interesting kind of perspective, especially when, you know, as the caller proposed, that some historians would say that surrender was just around the corner. We look at history, surrender didn't happen after Hiroshima. Surrender didn't happen after Nagasaki even right away. Why would we think they were just about to surrender?
Yeah, and it was not only, there were the fire bombings at the very end, and the revolution within the palace ended after, you know, we had a few warlords who were saying, oh, yeah, you're reporting a fleet approaching us that's twice as big as the one that hit Normandy? No way. They're mostly cardboard and plywood ships, and we let their scout planes come and see the fleet, and they went back and reported that, no, this is not a phantom fleet. It's real. And it was the combination of that and the fire bombings and Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the 6 months of fire bombing before that with 67 cities that completely disappeared that brought about the end. Conventional war had a very good chance of ending it without the atomic bombs. If Hitler had been killed by that, the attempt to assassinate him, and the whole process had been moved up almost a year, yes, there's a very good chance that Japan would have surrendered without the atomic bombs.
West of the Rockies, John is in Orange County on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino. John?
Yes, good evening, Mr. Punnett, and good evening, Mr. Pellegrino. Thank you very so much for having the show and giving the enlightenment of all the information you're giving. Mr. Pellegrino, the question I ask for you, should we have a nuclear strike, say, in the San Francisco area on an ICBM level or strength? What would be the repercussions on the West Coast, and what could we expect and how soon in Orange County?
I think the repercussions would be far beyond the West Coast. I think in this country, we would be screaming out for blood and missiles would be flying somewhere. And then you get into a situation where the world could go mad. And there are things that have been looked at and developed in recent years where, you know, 20 years ago, the novel and the film On the Beach was science fiction, but that's something that could be deliberately done right now. It is possible to irradiate the whole planet with the right kind of bomb. And who knows, someone might have the idea of doing that. It wouldn't happen as quickly as it did in On the Beach. It might take about 2 years for everyone to die, but it would be the end of birds and mammals on this planet.
Charles, what are some of the new things that you came across in your research that you incorporated into Last Train from Hiroshima?
Oh, where would I begin? just so many new things. Of course, I'm always looking at the old shock cocoon effect to try to figure out how is it that these things form. I would say one of the new things would be actually the people themselves, what they came to with coming out of it thinking that we have to look toward the future, not toward the past. We, as Mr. Yamaguchi had said once, that if you lead people to blame, if you go back to Pearl Harbor, someone will be arguing, well, why did they bomb Pearl Harbor? What caused that? And eventually the process of blame will go all the way back to blaming the first self for dividing, and that you have to look toward the future, that this can never happen again,
right.
That nuclear war has to end with the hypocenter at Nagasaki, and that no city should ever experience another hypocenter. And, you know, if you just read the first three chapters, and I did an experiment because people were telling me, oh, no, you know, the conservatives are going to rip you apart if you even write a book on this subject. And so one of the most conservative people I know of, who works with my Uncle Dondi, I had him as a test give the first three chapters to this guy who worked in his office, who was always flinging around the phrase, nuke them. You know, just
right.
Nuke them all and let God sort them out.
Right.
And in the third chapter, he came back to Don with tears in his eyes, and he said, I never knew what happens to the people under these things. And he said he would never, ever use the phrase nuke them again. As another test, I gave it to a scientist I knew in Israel who had written an editorial about why Israel should not only possess the atomic bomb, but should be willing to go forth under the right circumstances with a preemptive attack. He said, literally, do unto the other fellow as the other fellow would do unto Israel, and do it first. He came back after reading the entire book, and he said, you know, I didn't know what I was saying before. I did not know the whole facts about these weapons. And he said, now I know, and now the world should know, and that he no longer believes in the preemptive strike. He said, now that we really know, any country that's the first to use one of these weapons, it knows the unforgivable sin. Anyone who ever uses one of these first ever again, anywhere, for any reason whatsoever.
Well, there was so much biographical information in the book that I did not know. And one thing I'll never forget, and I don't really want to tell the story, but I'll leave it up to anybody who wants to read it in the book, is that the person who saw a guy who had survived the blast and going down the road in what she thought were tap shoes, based on the sound of the tap shoes. And that's all I'll say, and then you go look it up. Last train from Hiroshima. Alan is in the Rocky Mountains, first-time caller on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino. Alan?
Yes, I just want to make a few comments. We have one of the greatest, first of all, Mr. Pellegrino, but it's one of the best persons you've ever had on your show.
He's very
tremendous
good.
Insight. Tremendous.
Good guy.
Now, the first comment I want to make is I agree 100% with his thesis. And your thesis also, especially yours. China, the Japanese were poised to bring a half a million to a million troops back to the mainland for the epic center of the great battle after Iwo Jima, where the Allies were massing. They also had developed some pretty nasty weapons that they were hiding out.
The Chinese?
The Japanese
yeah. were right.
And the thesis, if you would have needed more than 400,000 Purple Hearts. Because they, like you said, the children were in it, the females, and then you have there's the evidence that they were going to force Chinese to participate in the carnage, and Russia of course was aiming to they would have met would have came in from the north,
well
support the Chinese. Against the Allied forces. I'll wait on a comment before I go on my next comment.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid we're going to run out of time here, too, so let's do that one and get Charles to comment, because we're just going to get one more caller in. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, one thing I do say in the beginning of the book, and all the facts are there, so I guess people can figure out and argue from the book afterward, oh, should we have dropped the bombs? Shouldn't we drop the bombs? But that's not what this, I say right in the beginning of the book, let other people argue elsewhere whether or not the bombs should have been dropped. This is what happens underneath these things. And it's written in the hope that no one anywhere will ever experience this again. And, with Mr. Yamaguchi, James Cameron and I, he called us both to his bed when he knew the time was near at 93, that he didn't have much time left. And, he said, I've been the torture all my life, and now I have to pass it on to you, and you too must become the torch. And I look at it as, we have to spread that out ourselves and spread out other torches for Mr. Yamaguchi. This, you know, he was a guy who started as a weapons designer and became this Gandhi-esque figure, a man of peace. And several of the people, you know, some of these amazing people have come through this whole tribulation, not only in Hiroshima. I've noticed that some of the kindest people I've known have survived some of the most horrible things. I've known two of the Schindler's List survivors, several Auschwitz survivors, and they say that this next part of their life has to be put toward shining a little life into people's lives wherever they can.
I love that. There was several times I've seen your book cited as the next project that James Cameron has committed himself to doing after Avatar. Where does that stand?
Well, going to have to sit on it zen-like for a while and figure out how to do it. And you know, if he wants to do it as a next project, well, right now it's he can afford to do anything he wants and even take time off to do whatever he wants. I just have a picture I've received. He's on an aircraft carrier somewhere in the Persian Gulf, taking a little time off, bringing Avatar and all the outtakes from the film and all sorts of other things, entertaining our troops over there, showing the film and some hilarious outtakes.
I love that. I think we have time for Frank in Florida, real quick on Coast to Coast for Charles Pellegrino. Frank?
Excellent. Thank you. Ian, excellent show tonight. Mr. Pellegrino, my father was over in Japan after the bombs. I guess it was the repatriation or the occupation. He has pictures of that clock tower. They took him to he has a picture in his dresser, and I'm going to go look at it next week when I get home. But my question is, he remembers, and he won't talk much about it, but he remembers women, naked women, that had looked like they were completely clothed. It was their silk kimonos that had the ink had burned into their skins.
Flower patterns that were branded into the skin. The white reflected. The dark colors were branded into the skin.
Mm. Well, there are a million stories that are told and many more yet to be told. Charles Pellegrino.
If there's just a moment. What the last caller mentioned is that his father didn't talk about it. And we're losing these veterans. We're losing these survivors, not only in Hiroshima and elsewhere, but it's a generation that will be passing, and if you have a parent or a grandparent who was anywhere in that war, get the history down. Get them to talk about it if you can.
Thanks for doing what you did already on that. Deus te amat, and I do too.